Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this past week's shows. On Wednesday, August 21st, Joe was joined by the Jane and William White Professor of Behavioral Sciences at Northwestern University and past president of the International Communication Association, Nashir Contractor, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer at the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
Tap into some of Nasha's knowledge here by just taking a simple example from the last 24 hours where former President Trump shared a fake image of Vice President Harris at a communist event, looking a lot like the Democratic National Convention. Trump repeatedly called Harris Comrade Kamala, accusing her of supporting socialist policies during a rally and in fundraising emails. His remarks referenced Harris's recent economic proposal targeting price gouging. The Harris campaign has yet to comment on Trump's posts. And after a while, I think that job probably just gets a little overwhelming. There she is. It's a picture. I see it. It's right in front of God and everybody. There she is talking to the crowd at the DNC and the sickle, the flag, the whole thing. It's all there.
Absolutely. I think this the idea of how misinformation and fake news has evolved over the last few presidential cycles and campaigns has been really interesting. For initially, when social media came about, the question was anyone could post anything on that particular issue. And so you'd see the notion of information being believed that because you saw it yourself and or other right. people saw it. And of course, that entire industry of creating that has become so much easier because of technologies, because of AI, whether it is visuals, but it's not just Photoshop anymore. It can be much better and sophisticated ways of looking at it. What the research has shown us on that particular topic is that there is a definite systematic bias where information that is considered as misinformation, which is just something that somebody made up, or disinformation where it was intentionally propagated to serve some goal. And this example that you just gave would be an example of disinformation because it had a certain purpose, tends to travel much faster and much more quickly and reach much larger audiences than traditional information. And one may say, how does that happen? And it is because it's somewhat unique, it is somewhat novel, but the research, especially work that was done by a colleague of mine, Sinan Aral, who is at MIT, who did a massive global project that showed systematically that the speed, the velocity, as he calls it, of this information and the depth with which this information gets through is remarkable. Some of you may remember that there was a quote that a lie goes twice around the world before truth put on its boots.
Yep. Yeah.
And do you know who said that? Well, the general notion about it was that that was said by Mark Twain. Yeah. It turns out that also is misinformation.
Of course. It was Abraham Lincoln.
I think I saw that on TV. No, actually, I'm not sure, but it is an example of how misinformation about that topic.
I was just writing that quote down.
Is that right? Yeah. But I think that this is what's gotten really bad about this now. The most recent wrinkle is that because of the fact that we have this kind of misinformation, now people can propagate and give even true information the label of misinformation,
yeah.
which makes it so much more difficult to be able to parse what is true and what is fake in this particular context. And that, I think, is particularly true for this cycle. That's new in this cycle.
I do. I think it's helpful that schools, undergraduate, high schools, graduate programs are educating young people mm-hmm. on how to identify and be critical of mis and disinformation. Yeah. But I do think that generations sort of outside of that yeah. reach yeah. are still struggling to, know to or to think to fact check the images that are coming through. Mm-hmm. But I don't, I think those images are not actually intended to convince people that Harris was giving a speech at a communist rally or that or that Taylor Swift endorsed Trump. I think it's just to plant the idea. Yeah. And then the idea itself creates its own narrative in the viewers and kind of attaches in an unconscious bias way.
Well, so, and, I'm sorry. Well, I was just going to say that one of the other things why I use that example is that on my phone yesterday came up a notification that that had been posted on Truth Social. So, and I do not remember the culprit because it came to me from Apple News as a notification, but it was either Huffington Post, Time Magazine, or the Wall Street Journal. I think I know who. Anyway, but I mean, the fact that you're covering it as well, right?
Yes.
I mean, the fact that the press is then covering that. Would I have known otherwise that it was out there?
Yeah.
Probably not had it not been delivered to my phone.
Right. So that speaks to the notion that, you know, everyone has the right to freedom of speech, but the distinction is freedom of reach. And when you have certain platforms that then amplify these messages,
that's good. And that's t-shirt worthy.
That's the argument of taking it further. And, you know, is it responsible for us to propagate things? And that's also a paradox, because if your goal is, and you know, some of our colleagues in the communication have been very involved with factcheck.org and so on, and a lot of it is, are you contributing to the problem when you go out and say this piece of information is misinformation and thereby telling more people about the information that you are labeling as misinformation?
I would not have known about that Harris communist post, but for this conversation, because my algorithms would never have shown it to me, right? It's not on my social media.
Well, that makes me feel bad.
No, but you are propagating disinformation.
Well, but my
communism.
Well, but what, you know, but this is one of the problems, Joe, which is that these things get picked up by other media.
Right.
Right. So in other words, I learned about that also through, you know, a news story from one of the actually major papers. And then what happens is that stuff then gets picked up on a Fox or something like that, where what they're able to say is this is being accused of being fake news.
Or right.
This is, you know, in other words, they're spinning things. And then, you know, the part that stuns me is we keep, on this show, we usually criticize Fox as a right-wing station. There's a bunch of the right-wingers who think of Fox as
not right-wing,
like,
enough.
CNN. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there are stations
fair and balanced
out there.
Is the slogan they've used.
Yeah, I mean, it's stunning. And same thing out on social media. So as Nosh knows, I occasionally have to go crawling in the muck of some of these social media things that are scary. We were looking at some of where the whole QAnon thing came from and how that spread. And, you know, to do it, we had to look at things called 8chan, which most people haven't heard of. And I'm blanking on the name, Nosh. What was the right-wing equivalent of Twitter that, or Facebook? Anyway, there was something that got taken down after January 6th. We have the whole corpus of what had been on there when it was taken down. And just going through it, it's scary, because what you see is a few manipulators who are able to get a lot of other people to repeat what they say, and then it comes back to them, and they say, you know, we heard that, right? Yeah. So they kind of deny that they created it, and it really gets these complicated feedback loops. But some of this stuff is scary. And you know, that's coming out now a little bit more in the media, because almost all of these shooters, almost all of these real crazies who've been caught, you know, that's where they dwelt. And then, you know, sort of they put stuff onto their Facebook page, but it came from this really. This isn't even talking about what's called the dark web, which is we're just definitely not going down there. But it really is a time where understanding this stuff is going to be important. Nosh mentioned web science before.
Yep.
And we were seeing kind of a decline in people paying attention to that. And now it's growing again. Our audiences are growing. Our you know, the number of people who are engaging in it. Because the understanding of how social media is impacting society has just grown tremendously.
So obviously, Nosh, you study this, you look at this. We know what a lot of the problems are. We know what's going out. So how do we, as citizens, both active and even inactive, will look and of what we can do to try to be good internet citizens to understand what is being conveyed to us?
That's an incredibly important question and a tough question. I think there's a recognition that this is a socio-technical problem, and that is the solutions have to include both social issues and technical issues as you look at this. Nick talked about the fact that the younger generation is being educated in schools and being told what to do, etc. That is part of the solution. We shouldn't make the assumption that young people are always savvier about this. Work that has been done by one of my colleagues, Esther Hargitay, shows that the general notion that young people are very savvy on this and old people are not is actually not true, that young people can also make big mistakes on these issues. So digital literacy, being able to know how to read and how to parse out what is fact versus misinformation or disinformation is certainly a big part of that issue. Another part of it is having institutions like factcheck.org and other kinds of platforms that are going to try to look at being able to provide us some guidance on it. The social media and traditional media platforms have a role where they are now being asked to flag what they consider as misinformation. I think it's striking that in this cycle, we routinely have media sources saying so-and-so has said a lie about this or continues to say this lie. I think that, you know, three presidents ago, we would not have said that about our presidents, but now, or former presidents. But now it's quite routine to be able to say it. So there is that aspect of it. And then I saved the technology for last. I said it's a socio-technical problem, but the technology also can play an important role in helping us decide and helping us be more cautious about it. There's a notion of water printing, of watermarks that you can put so that you can say that detect automatically whether something was created or generated through using AI technologies in addition. So I don't think the solution is any one of these, but it's all of these different things: digital literacy, social media platforms, third-party institutions,
regulation.
And regulation, of course, is what brings a lot of this together. Thank you.
I mean, the scary thing, too, though, we were talking to Marty Baron of the Washington Post, Boston Globe, and Miami Herald yesterday. He has a new book out called Collision of Power. And we had an interesting discussion, but one of the things that he brought up at his time at the New York Times as Trump was starting his ascent is that they began the fact-checking. And they ended up with 30,000 within the first term, 30,000 lies. But here's what they found. Nobody cared. We've identified them.
Yeah.
We've identified this as fake. We've identified this as not true. We've identified this as being a fallacy. Okay.
Yep.
Now what do you got?
You're right. Three presidents ago is probably about right. We were very hesitant. I was on the editorial board as this and the editorial page as this evolution occurred, but we just never used the word lie, liar, anything like that in the past. Mm-hmm. And it actually predated Trump that I persuaded the board we should put this in an editorial. It was when the Senate majority in New York pledged, they actually took an oath that they would put in an independent redistricting process in New York if they were reelected. They came, this is a big statement that they made, and then they, the day after the election, or within very shortly after the election, they said, "Oh, wait, we can't do that. We just realized there's something in the Constitution that prevents us." And I said, "We have to call these guys what they are. They were liars." And here's how I justified that: they took an oath, they signed it, and they said, "This is a sacred oath we're taking." I said, "You can't. It's nothing but a lie if you break your oath." So we started using that, and then Trump came along, and now 30,000. It becomes so trivial.
Yes.
The word lie. the word disinformation, the word false statement. What do you do when nobody cares about that? I've had multiple arguments on the internet where someone will start an argument with me, and I'm like, 30,000 lies. This is what you want in a president? Well, yeah, but you're not talking about his policy on this. And it's like, I don't want to talk about the policy on this. I want to talk about the overall character of this person. And the overall character of this person is that he is a the adjective is just on the tip of my tongue, and I can't use it.
There is actually a technical term for it, and in the communications and philosophy space, which we can't use on the radio, it's abbreviated BS. But if you actually look at Google Scholar, I'm sorry, Google Scholar is something that we use to see how many publications on a particular topic and how many citations they've gotten. That word has been in philosophy for about 15, 20 years now. The top paper on it is a seminal paper, has thousands of citations. Citation is someone else mentioning in their paper. And it's all about the difference between someone who's lying in the sense of, I'm trying to fool you into something, and somebody who is just making a statement that sounds correct and they don't care. And that's really the issue, I think.
And that's that partly the communist flag thing, is that even when I find a lot of discussions with people where they repeat a lie and then you call them out on it, and you say, this has been fact-checked. This has been, and here's the fact check if you want to go do it. And then they're like, yeah, but you know what? It would be true. It feels true. And this is an example. All right, it's an exaggerated one, and I was just joking. But, you know, what are you doing with that?
But I think that there's an assumption we are making, which psychologists know not to be true. And that is that if you give people the facts, it'll always rule. Right. And Bob Cialdini, who is a psychologist, has written extensively and reviewed the literature on this extensively, that some people have a desire to be right, and others have a desire to be liked. And if you talk to somebody and you say, oh, if I can just give you the facts on climate change, shouldn't you change your mind? And they go, no, but I'm entitled to my beliefs. I don't care about the facts. And I think we make the mistake that just because you give somebody facts, that's automatically going to work. And the more important psychology shows that sometimes people are more likely to be persuaded to do something, to be influenced, not by giving them facts because they don't have a desire to be right, but by giving them friendship, giving them adulation because they have a desire to be liked. And I think politicians and campaigners and people in marketing have long understood that influence has to be understood both as an ensemble of fact, but also other strategies that are not based entirely on fact.
I mentioned earlier Stephanie Grisham, who was former press secretary for President Trump, and she spoke at the Democratic National Convention last night. And she said that the president said to her, Stephanie, you have to go out and you have to say this. This is after January 6th. And she said, but it's not true. And he said, if you say it enough, it becomes true. And she said, I couldn't bring myself to doing it. So, I mean, part of the problem, too, is that you need more people to say, I can't bring myself to doing that, which is an issue. Nick.
Yeah, and I wanted actually to go back to the notion that some people just want to be liked. I think they also want to do, like, they want the response expected from them to be a thing that's comfortable for them to do.
Yes.
So with climate change, it's one thing to say there's climate change and we're all facing mass extinction. It's another thing to say, you know, you can take these very small, comfortable steps and you don't have to turn your whole life upside down.
Yes.
So it has, the truth has to connect also to an action that people are comfortable with, because if the truth is too far away from that, you just lose that connection.
So I'll give an example of
this
that.
And I think that is the liked. It's not just that they want to like the fact or they like the person.
Yes.
They also want to like the answer.
And they want to like themselves. They want to reduce the dissonance. So there was a study done for a political campaign a few decades ago where if you went to a neighborhood and asked people, would you be willing to support my candidate by simply signing this petition in support of this person? And some people did, and some people did not. And then they went to a different neighborhood. Oh, so they came back to that same neighborhood a week later and said, do you mind if we put a sign outside your in your yard in support of this candidate? And many of those who had signed it said, sure, you can put us, because by now it was being internally consistent. They were taking these small steps that you said, Nick. They agreed to sign it first, and now they said, well, if I signed it, I'm more likely now, I'm open to the idea of putting a placard. They went to a different neighborhood and didn't start with the request for the signature, just went directly to, can we put a sign in your yard? A vast majority of the people said no.
Nosh Contractor on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, August 21st. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel of the Week in Review after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, August 22nd, Joe Donahue was joined for the panel discussion by partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, theater artist, arts advocate, activist, and executive director for Project SAGE in Lakeville, Connecticut, Kristen Vangenhoven, and live from the DNC in Chicago, Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan.
Kathy Sheehan, mayor of Albany, at the Democratic National Convention, calling us from Chicago. We couldn't be more thrilled to have you on the phone with us. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. So generally, how are things going?
Oh, I mean, it is just so exciting here, the enthusiasm. It's just an amazing thing to see, people coming together. You know, I was at the convention in 2016, and, you know, there were still the Bernie folks, and, you know, it was great. It was wonderful. But this is just, it's hard to describe, but because there's just such unity in the room and on that floor. And it's just been really fun. I think the most thrilling thing for me is that I actually got an I'm Jelly text from my son yesterday, because Lil Jon came out. I don't know if you all got to see that.
Yes.
We were doing the roll call. And so to have my 24-year-old jealous of me at a convention, it was kind of cool. And we all conceded that, you know, Georgia won in the roll call.
Yeah.
Who could top that?
That's right. Georgia certainly won during the roll call. It's an amazing sense. I mean, from watching it on television, both during the primetime coverage and just throughout the day, it seems as though this is you can't kick the smile off these people's faces. It is everyone just seems to be joyous, and I don't know how you try to I don't know how you then say to that, okay, I mean, the big question that all the media is having is, well, how do you keep up this momentum? And I guess that's a fair question, Kathy.
Well, I mean, from the people that I'm speaking to from all over the country, they have been seeing incredible turnout when they're doing door-to-door calls with volunteers. I'm a surrogate for the campaign, and I kicked off a phone bank that was happening, people from the West Coast calling in to New Hampshire, calling into Wisconsin, and people are turning out to volunteer in record numbers. So there's a tremendous amount of enthusiasm, and it's in that hall, right? We're all delegates and Democrats who are here for the convention, so you would expect it. But what is happening across the country at our hotel, we have Wisconsin in the house, Oklahoma in the house, Maryland, they're seeing that same level of enthusiasm at the ground level, whether it's a call for canvassing, a call for phone banking, call for writing letters and postcards. So, you know, we're seeing it, and it's really the diversity of age range as well. You know, young people really fired up and getting involved. So we do have to, this is going to be a tough election. This is going to be, it's going to be close. We've got to fight for every vote. But I think what you're hearing is that we're really speaking to all Americans at this convention. And that's the other piece of this that I hope is coming through with respect to the television coverage of that, is that this isn't just about Democrats. It's about all Americans, and it's about our future. And I think that we have a message that resonating really across the political spectrum.
Hey, Kathy, it's Judy Patrick. I have two questions. First, are all those Wisconsin people wearing the cheese hats?
Yeah, they are.
I was wondering about those.
I was asked about that. I mean, I think that New York needs to really step it up 4 years from now, because not only did we not have somebody rapping when we did the roll call, but we do not have a hat game going at all.
Second,
I think I respect the state of New York for not having a hat game, but I don't know. That's just me.
Maybe folks can write in, what would the New York hat be?
Well, you know, it's going to be like the Statue of Liberty crowd or something.
That's exactly
I don't know.
I thought.
All right, second question. So Oprah was the big surprise guest last night. Let's make some news here. Who's tonight's big surprise guest?
So, you know, they don't tell us. It was a surprise to us. She was not on the list, didn't know that she was going to be there. So, you know, I can't wait to see who it's going to be. But, you know, it was really wonderful to all of the speakers. You know, I thought Hakeem Jeffries, you know, you're probably going to get to this, Joe. He was great. I was actually with a group of mayors from across the country when he was speaking, and I mean, they were blown away, and that was a really fun moment in this convention. So I'm waiting and anticipating along with you.
Well, the big news last night, of course, was Tim Walz and accepting the nomination and speaking. And here is a guy who a few weeks ago, most people in America probably were not aware of him. And then he's on one of the biggest stages in all the nation and in the world, and talking about, I would say, a very modest background of not even talking about his political career, but talking very much about his career prior to that. What is the mood in the room regarding him, regarding the choice, and the feeling of the message that he conveyed on that Chicago stage last night?
Well, he felt a ton of love last night. Everybody was on their feet, couldn't wait for him to come out. When the football team came out, that was just a brilliant moment. Kudos to whoever came up with that idea. And I think that in addition to him just being a really sincere, relatable person, somebody with a background that I think will be very beneficial in the White House, because he can relate to average Americans. I think what I heard people talking about was what a brilliant choice it was and how it reflects on Kamala Harris's leadership. Because, as you said, most people had never heard of him, didn't know who he was, didn't know anything about his background. She had a lot of pressure. She had 2 weeks to pick a vice presidential candidate, a running mate, in what is going to be a very close race where everything was changing all at once. And I listened to him last night. I looked at what he brought to that stage, what he brings to that ticket, and I thought, Kamala Harris is ready for this, because the choices that you make reflect your leadership ability, and I think that this is a choice that demonstrated exactly who Kamala Harris is and who she'll be as president of the United States.
He tweeted last night, it's the fourth quarter, we're down a field goal, but we're on offense. We're driving down the field, and boy, do we have the right team to win this. Is that a fair assessment?
I think so. I think for all the enthusiasm here, nobody is taking their foot off the accelerator. This is going to be a close race. And we have to continue to get the message out there that we've been talking about, you know, these past 3 days, and that we'll talk about again today, about the future of this country and the direction that we're going in, and why it's so important that we continue on the path that we're on and not go backwards. And there are a lot of people's rights that are on the line. We heard about, you know, the reproductive freedoms. We've heard about the kitchen table issues that people are dealing with, and we recognize that we're not ahead in this. We've got to continue to work for every vote.
We're all hanging on every word you say here, Kathy, because we're just, it's so exciting to have you calling in from actually being there, because we're all smiling and nodding, and it's just awesome to kind of hear your boots on the ground perspective of it. Everything you say this fourth quarter and what he said last night, this is where I think the short time frame is really beneficial. Because holding this momentum for, as Governor Westmore said, right, 75 days and one wake up is a lot easier than when you're doing it and you still have like 18 months in a campaign. We all know that it's going to be up and down. And I've really appreciated two things that they've been doing during the DNC. And it sounds like that message has really been put into action by everyone that's there of like, we got to go up and down the ticket. Like, we have to get the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives, and also, like, don't take this for granted. Like, don't take this momentum for granted. Like, we really have to keep our head down and move that forward. And from what you're saying, Mayor, it sounds like everyone's really taken that to heart and already, like, putting that into action. Like, you're already making calls and stuff right from there.
Yeah, there's work happening here with respect to, again, continuing to campaign and phone bank. You know, it's funny. Somebody said to me, you know, I haven't seen anybody from the campaign. And I said, yeah, because they're out campaigning, right? The campaign staff, most of them, I've seen a few folks here, but most of them are nose to the grindstone, working it and making sure that those field offices are doing all that they can do to get volunteers to turn out. And so everyone's working.
I have a question. Like, they've done such a great job of making this vice presidential candidate, you know, the nominee, Tim Walz, this everyday, relatable guy, you know, who's done these amazing things that, of course, the Democratic Party fully endorses in the state that he governs. I'm curious about how the flip side of that and his, like, awareness of foreign issues, foreign security, relationships with leaders of other countries, you know, is that something that you think Kamala Harris is going to address tonight? Because we all, you know, I sit here and I go, okay, well, how's he going to do, you know, with all of those responsibilities that come with people in the White House? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, again, I think it's about putting people around you who are experts with respect to those types of subject matters. And again, I think that Kamala Harris's choice of Walz as a vice presidential candidate, as her running mate, demonstrates that she's very good at taking in a lot of information and then finding the right person, right? And so, you know, all of these issues, you know, whether it's Ukraine, Israel, these are all very serious top-of-mind issues. And they're not going to wait for an election. They're happening in real time. And I think we have Vice President Harris, who knows these issues and has been working on them alongside the president. And we have in Tim Walz somebody who's just so authentic. He's just an authentic person who has demonstrated that he can learn new things. He can adapt. He is going to put everything into the job. And I don't think there's anything he can't learn and can't come up to speed on. And so I think we've got a great team. And these international issues are very serious. And we've got, you know, a great, you know, when you look at the team that President Biden has assembled, I think we've got an A team working on it. And there's going to be an A team that continues to work on those issues.
Sienna.
I was going to say, hi, Mayor. I'm also jelly, like your son, that I wasn't there to see little John. I'm very, very jelly. I have downloaded the Spotify playlist of all the roll call songs, and it is excellent, by the way. But,
good idea.
You know, we knew one of the main goals of this, you know, DNC was to introduce the vice president and Tim Walz to the country. And they've done an excellent job of that. But what I continue to hear over and over again is about the lack of specific policies being mentioned at the DNC. And so I was just, I know last night during Tim Walz's speech, he gave a little snippet, so to speak, of what the policies were and what you could go talk to your undecided voters about, which I thought was an excellent moment. But what are you hearing about the policies? I'm hearing that the vice president is supposed to speak in more specific terms tonight, but I'm not sure. So what are you hearing about that?
Well, look, I think that, you know, the platform is available for anybody to look at. And, you know, typically the convention is more about speaking to people's hearts, speaking to the values that the party holds, and having people really get to know those who are leaders in this party. Certainly the president and vice presidential candidates, but we've heard from a number of outstanding leaders. And all you need to do is look at what they're doing. You know, Wes Moore. You know, the Hakeem Jeffries, and look at what they're fighting for. And so, you know, I think when you get down to the specifics, you know, Vice President Harris has talked about wanting to invest in home ownership. And we know what that looks like. We know how to do home ownership assistance. We do it now. We get funding from HUD, and we're able to help people with down payment assistance so that they can get into that first home. She wants to take that program and grow it and expand it and recognize that when you give people the opportunity to start to build generational wealth, you grow the economy because people are able to put their children through college, start a new small business, and have that American dream. And so that's a policy that we've been talking about. We've been talking about continuing to drive down the price of prescription drugs. That's a very important pocketbook issue for the average American. And, you know, there's a stark contrast, right? You have a presidential candidate who, when he was president, tried to get rid of the, you know, Obamacare, and would do the same. You know, they want to roll back benefits, and we're talking about how do we ensure that the average American can make ends meet and not worry that they're going to lose their home because of a medical bill. So these are areas where there's stark contrast between the policies of what a Harris administration would look like and the policies of the former president seeking to become president. And so, I hear the media saying that, and I think those are Republican talking points because I feel like we are talking about these policy issues. We talk about them all the time.
All right, so let me morph Sienna's excellent question with your excellent answer together for me to ask this question. So if all the information is up there and it's the platform and it's available, for you as a mayor of the city of Albany, is there something missing? Is there something that we are not talking about that we should be talking about that gives you concern?
Well, no. I mean, I think we are talking about, let's talk about, you know, a huge policy issue, right? Reproductive freedom, which you know, is really about our autonomy as individuals. So we're talking about reproductive freedom, but we're also talking about gay rights, gay marriage, and a whole host of issues that I think are really important to people. And there is another stark contrast between the policies of the other party and the other candidate and what a Harris administration would seek to ensure for those of us who this is a really important issue. I think we are talking about very real issues. I was at a panel discussion with Governor Whitmer yesterday afternoon, or I think it was 2 days ago. It's you lose track of time here.
Yes.
Where we talked about reproductive freedom alongside gun safety, right? Because these issues, while you wouldn't necessarily think of them as going together, they do go together. How do we keep people safe? And how do we prevent mass shootings and mass loss of life? And so that's another issue that Democrats are talking about. We want common sense gun laws that keep us safe. And that is, again, a stark contrast between what the Democrats would continue to do and bring to the White House and what the other party would. So I can't think of an issue that really matters to our, the average American and to our cities that we aren't talking about. And I've said this over and over again. I was mayor under the other guy. And I have to tell you, I'm dead serious.
No,
it was scary time. It was scary time. You know, we didn't have access to, the information that we needed and the help that we needed, especially during the pandemic. We were ready to lay off hundreds of city employees, firefighters, police officers, because we have to balance our budget. And he said, too bad. I'm not sending you aid. I'm not going to help. So, that was the answer that we got under the other guy. So, yeah, as a mayor, the issues that the Democrats are talking about and the relationship and the partnership that we will have is something that's going to be really important for not just the residents of the city of Albany, but the entire region and the entire country.
We'll have a much better sense of this in just a few months. But 74 days to Election Day, and you look at it of where we were a month and four days ago, I believe. And this is starkly different than that. And I'm just wondering, in your opinion, has that actually been in some way helpful, that it has distilled everything and has focused everyone really quickly to a point where that this excitement that we're seeing, the motivation that we're seeing, the trouble that the Trump campaign has in coming up with a message, that all of this is caused by this fact that we have taken an election that we thought we knew exactly what was going to happen for 2.5 years, and all of a sudden, 90 days before, it all changes.
I mean, I'd really be interested in hearing what the other panelists think of that. I mean, for me, I've known President Biden for many years. I've watched his career. I've had the opportunity to speak with him and to meet with him on a number of occasions. And I think it speaks to his ability to see that there needed to be a change and that this was what was best for the country. But, to me, I'd love to hear what others think of that.
I'll say that I think it's exactly how you put it for most part, Joe. I think that there is this electric energy around it once this decision was made, and we all kind of coalesced around Vice President Harris to push her over, to win the election, because we know what the alternative is. However, as someone that practices in something such as immigration, Mayor, that's a big issue over the last year with us, especially when it comes to the Biden campaign, Biden administration. We had some rough times, I would say. And so I think that you can do that. You can push Vice President Kamala Harris and say, go, you can do this. Also hold her accountable. What are you going to do about immigration? What are you going to do about border security? We have not seen much. We've seen some new policies. I'm going to applaud them coming down from the executive branch for immigration. But we're still waiting, and we're still looking for those concrete solutions that we know maybe only Congress could do. But we still want to hear that. And so I think you can still hold the Biden administration accountable and Vice President Harris accountable for these issues such as immigration, and at the same time coalesce around her and understand that this is still the greater good, and this is the best answer and the optimal candidate for this election.
Sienna Freeman Tolbert on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, August 22nd. We'll return with the final segment of this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this break. Thank you. Welcome to the final segment of this morning's roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, August 23rd, Joe Donahue was once again joined by Sienna Freeman-Tolbert of the Albany law firm Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, this time in studio with Siena College professor of economics Aaron Pasitti, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman.
Of course, the big story is that the nomination was accepted last night by Kamala Harris. She, the vice president's speech on Thursday, capped an ebullient four-day convention in Chicago that showcased the party's reinvigorated chances against Donald Trump in the wake of President Biden's decision to step aside. Before a convention hall packed with supporters in symbolic suffragette white, Ms. Harris became the second woman to formally accept the Democratic Party's nomination as she tries to break through as the nation's first female president. So three paragraphs in, talking about fashion. Not bad for the New York Times this time. Not that she talked about that. Instead, Ms. Harris wrapped herself in the language of patriotism and American exceptionalism, unspooling the story of her upbringing by a single mother to present herself as a leader who understands the strains and aspirations of the middle class. And again, that from the New York Times. So general reactions from the group, and then we'll get into specifics as we move forward this morning. Sienna, you said you were pretty sure you were going to cry. How did it go? You did?
I did. I cried. It was the ramp up for me. It started as soon as her sister came out. Her sister started talking about her. Yeah. The tears were just, I was just emotional. And then
Roy Cooper really did it for you.
Roy wasn't bad, actually. But the minute she came out, she started walking out. And you kind of felt the moment, like she had to stop people from clapping. I mean, I started tearing up. My son came over. He was holding me. It was very emotional seeing her up there. It was monumental. You knew she was there. She deserved to be there. She had the qualifications to be there. And you knew she could do a good job just based on the run-up to her speech, the people that came out there and spoke on her behalf, even Roy Cooper, who did an excellent job leading in.
And
so
Adam Kunzinger.
Exactly, exactly. And so then the minute she started speaking about her mother, because she started very low, very somber, and it was a beautiful story, and I was just done. I was done. I was crying throughout most of that speech. I would say up until she accepted the nomination, the tears kind of dried up, and then she started getting into her policy and talking about, you know, her versus Trump, and that was very inspiring as well. It's exactly what I wanted.
It's one of those things that I think was interesting, is most people had a list going in. I mean, I asked the question yesterday of the group, what do you expect, what do you hope to hear? And most of those checklists, like,
she went through it.
They went through it.
It was very systematic. I was like, I see your closing argument, ma'am. This is a prosecutor. Then I started seeing her layout. I saw her pattern. I was like, I found your pattern. All right, what's the next issue on the docket?
That's great.
And I was like, okay, and then you versus Trump. Now next one.
Right.
You versus Trump. Next one. It was very systematic. Much. I saw her in my legal eagle brain, and I was like, yes, sister attorney, I see you.
Yeah, very good.
Beautiful.
Libby Post.
Well, the Democrats have redefined, reframed, and rebranded the party as one that values freedom and redefining what freedom really means, one of patriotism and defining what patriotism really means. This party wrapped itself in the flag and these chants of USA, which we haven't seen, I don't know if I've ever seen it in my lifetime. I've been watching these things
for
a long time.
Well, certainly post-Gulf War.
Yeah, but this
George W. Bush.
And after 9/11. But
yeah,
in terms of this is who we are as a party, we haven't been patriots, believers in freedom. I mean, we are, but we haven't defined ourselves that way since maybe JFK. I mean, really, it's been a very, very long time. And so the party has now been rebranded as the patriots of this country, as the people who believe and can define what freedom really means in this country, and can move this country forward. And I think that that's just, you know, and she spoke to the center, and so did a lot of other of the speakers and the Republicans who came and talked about this isn't Republican or Democrat. This is about doing a vote for patriotism and democracy.
And oh, by the way, Democrats were happy.
Yes. And we were incredibly happy, which is rare. But we all are rowing. Look, I said,
you'll all get over it.
Right. I said all the time, and you can go back to all the shows when we talked about this and Biden and whether he should step down. I said, if he steps down, okay, but we have to go into that convention lockstep.
Mark Whitman.
Well, I want Kamala Harris to win perspective. She did a good job last night. She was clearly young, coherent, and confident, and that's a stark contrast to the alternative, frankly. I mean, Joe Biden's speech at the beginning of the convention showed us all he wasn't those three things. I do think it was notable that she took the opportunity to shepherd the hall in order to moderate its applause. There are limited opportunities to give leadership cues in a setting like that, and she took advantage of that one. She clearly has the behind-the-podium auto-cue performance down, which is something I don't think we necessarily assumed was the case.
Explain what you mean by that.
Was she from behind a podium with a auto cue or teleprompter in front of her? She gives a great speech.
Yes.
She did a good job last
yes.
night. And given we've more often seen her in off-the-cuff situations and in interviews, there are plenty of memes abound as to what she's done historically in those situations. So she's clearly made a step forward in the part of the communication that's required from behind the podium. I think she ticked all the boxes in terms of what people wanted to hear. I mean, she ticked them lightly in a sort of a faint number two pencil in many cases. She offered a skeletal outline of her policies and outlook. I do think she very adroitly handled the Hamas-Israel mm-hmm. conflict in Gaza. I think clearly with respect to national defense, when she said she wants to maintain a lethal force, the world's most lethal force instead of most effective force, that was an intentional choice of words. The Republicans, by hewing so closely to Christian white nationalism and the isolationism that comes with it, have left an opening for the Democrats. And she certainly took the occasion to exploit that yesterday. Now, we can get more into this later. I thought she did a good job of I think she was a little heavy on the Trump bashing, given how much of it had come before her. But I think it was fine. I do think this wasn't a soaring speech like the Obamas gave. I think she lacked a narrative through the speech that would have been sort of the A answer. She had one there about writing different stories, her mother's story, her story, the nation's story. But for some reason, the speechwriter seemed like it was sort of almost three pieces, and there wasn't a coherent, as coherent a theme through it as there could have been. I think that was a missed opportunity. And I'll also say, I'll give you this joke, and we can talk more about it later. But we had a joke in our family that when a Democrat at the convention promised something free, you take a swig of lemonade, because my son was involved in this project.
Game.
Now you have to take somebody else's lemonade, right? particularly when Bernie Sanders speaks. When she got to a middle class tax break, we actually had to drink the rest of the picture. I didn't know that was in her skeletal outline. Tactically,
seems like a game that would have been more fun at your house.
Yeah,
I think tactically what she's doing actually is pretty adroit. Trump can't effectively respond to that without looking less optimistic and without a complicated response. It is akin to what the Democrats are faced with on immigration. They can't just state what they want. They have to now back up every time and say what Donald Trump didn't want. It's a less forward direct position. So by sort of offering these overly optimistic, many times impractical economic policies, I think she's doing the right thing from, if I want her to get elected standpoint, I think it's totally impractical in terms of government, but we can get it governing, but we can get into that later.
Aaron.
I thought it was probably the most authentic presentation of a policy platform and a vision for the country that the Democrats have had since 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Biden won in 2020, but boy, that was just a boring convention. Granted, COVID wasn't, there were a lot of complicating factors. Hillary Clinton's convention in 2016 did not really inspire, and I'm not just saying that because of what happened in hindsight, but it seemed like people were actually speaking from the heart and from the gut, including Kamala. So I was happy to see that. It seems like there's and, you know, it's easy when you're rallying around an opposition like the Democrats have. So I found it to be authentic. She checked all the boxes. The speech didn't really reveal anything that wasn't previously known. But it was clearly pitched towards unlikely and independent voters. She wasn't going out on the limb talking about, you know, extremely radical policies or spending all of her time, you know, rebutting things Trump has said. It was clearly a, you know, positive vision that was more or less middle of the road to start to try to draw in the unlikely, undecided voters, particularly in the handful of swing states that will determine the election. So that was my initial reaction. The other thing, and I think you mentioned this, Libby, is the kind of retaking what patriotism and freedom means. And I'm going to go off on this later. But, you know, what's happened really beginning in 2016 has been the Republicans' ironic use of the American flag, where they're flying the flag as if they're patriots. But what that flag represents is entirely different. It's tough to think of a party in modern history that hates the United States and what it stands for so much as modern Republicans. So it was nice to see the Democrats aggressively trying to take that back.
We have to take a break. The one thing I would just add to what you said is that when she was speaking, it wasn't to that crowd and the United Center in Chicago.
No,
it was to the people at home. It was right to the camera and to the people at home, which I thought was very effective as well. We'll take a break. When we come back on the other side, we'll continue our conversation this morning. As always, you're welcome to join us, panel at WAMC.org. We will return after news. Is it a successful campaign event or an unsuccessful campaign event when at some point we said, well, Beyonce wasn't there?
I thought she was going to walk out at the end, but as we were just talking, Aaron said it would have upstaged Harris, which probably is true, but the place would have gone wild. But it was, it doesn't really matter. You had Pink, who was great. And her daughter, daughter has?
Yeah, Willow.
Wow.
Amazing.
And so she was great, and then the chicks were great. I don't know if they were off pitch or not, because I don't have any pitch. But
Aaron's a musician.
You know,
he's
picky. Okay, I'm not.
Sorry.
You know, but, you know, the entertainment value was there. And, look, they'll roll out Beyonce. They'll roll out Taylor Swift late September, all through October, when you need them. When you need to generate that kind of excitement going into Election Day. The biggest challenge now is to maintain this momentum over the next, 74 days, to get to November 5th and win. And that's not easy, because there are some people who think we've got this in the bag, and we cannot think that way, because it does come down to a handful of swing states and maybe 100,000 to 250,000 votes.
Libby Post on the Roundtable panel on Friday, August 23rd. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at WAMC.org, in the WAMC app, or via podcast. This has been the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.